Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
Darkening the door, I gotta describe here what's going on here, Kriti. This is a little
I'm thrown.
Unnerving.
I'm thrown.
Here. All right, let's start with Anurag Rana.
He walks in the door.
Freshly shaven. Now, the reason this is important, because he's had a scraggly beard, I'm calling it, for a couple, 3 years. I don't know if it was a pandemic thing, but I was petitioning for him to shave it off since the first time I saw it. That's gone. Looks a thousand times younger. I would say he looks 10 years younger.
I got to say, I saw him walking towards the radio studio, and I had to do a double take. I didn't even recognize him.
I know. Sorry. So we got that going for us.
Yeah.
And then we got Dan Ives. He covers technology stuff for Wedbush Securities.
For the record, though, I think I'm pro-scruff, just saying.
Are you? Okay. It's not even a choice here. With Anurag, you got to go. And then he's got the haircut. He's like, it's a whole new Anurag. All right. So Dan Ives comes in with a summer outfit that is right on the edge of being summer, cool, chic.
It's like fresh back from Bermuda. What's going on here?
Or it's right on that line of being cool and being obscene. I don't know where we are.
It's like a Picasso painting in a very strange way. Like, I don't even know what to say about it.
And you brought that look over to Asia, because I saw your postings on social media, Dan, when you were over on your marketing trip to Asia. You weren't holding back, were you?
No, I mean, we brought it from 212 over to Asia.
Oh, that's where the color's coming from. Okay, this makes sense.
Yeah, 212 color over to Asia. And I think, I think it worked well. It could be maybe a trend. If you start seeing some tech investors throughout Asia.
It's because of you.
It could... Besides AI and some of the themes, it could have a...
Let me just go to Anurag here. What does NVIDIA do, and why are they seemingly getting all this chip demand for AI? Is this hype-ish, or is it real?
Well, the hype part will always be driven by a little bit of valuation. But I think one of the things you have to think about when you run some of the very large workloads, even on the cloud, you need really fast computers and you really need faster chips. And NVIDIA is the leader in those chips out there, and they've really posted good numbers, which basically tells us that the world is investing a lot more in high-powered computers right now because of all the AI frenzy.
Before I go to Dan, can I just point out that the reason Anurag has haircut, it's fresh shaven and all that, is because there's an event happening this evening.
Oh, there
or
is?
This afternoon / evening. It is. Anurag, you want to tell them?
Yeah, there's a big semiconductor event we are having in the 120 Park about, we'll have Micron, Intel, and Global Foundries there talking about, the making of the chips in the U.S. We have an executive from Department of Commerce.
Yeah.
Perfect
C-suite
timing.
C-suite of some of the biggest and some of the best.
Bloomberg
very excited about that.
Boom.
Yeah, they are on top of it. So Mandeep Singh of Bloomberg Intelligence will be there. Anurag, of course, leading the charge. Good lineup. Dan, talk to us a little bit about this trade here. The idea that kind of AI is driving NVIDIA shares. NVIDIA isn't a pure play on AI necessarily. So how quickly does this 30% move in the stock get walked back?
Look, this is historic. I mean, in covering tech stocks 22 years, I've never seen anything in my career where you have a guidance raise 60% in a quarter. And I think the difference in why this is, I think the ripple effects here in terms of this gold rush that's happened in AI, it validates it. The monetization's real, because ultimately, as Anurag talks about, they're the ones that see it first. I believe, in my view, this is just the start. I think it's a revolution that's playing out. And in my view, Microsoft, Google, across the board, it's just the start of what I view as probably the biggest transformational theme that I've ever seen cover tech since late 90s.
You've been a tech bull for ages. So this is pretty, this makes a lot of sense that you would say that. What flips your view? What gets in the way of this?
It's when I talk, and I can tell you the last 3 weeks, like whether it's Asia, whether it's US, when I talk to CIOs, when I talk to product managers, and now they're looking to spend for every $100 in cloud spend, $35 to $40 incremental for AI. To me, that's the game changer. Hmm. That's why, like, look, those, if you're valuation centric, and we've talked about this, you would have missed the Facebook's, Netflix, yep. Tesla. I feel like this is one where we're talking conservatively $800 billion over mm-hmm. the next decade, incremental spend, and maybe aggressively in the trillions with the amount of names you count on two hands.
All right, so Anurag, explain to me, I mean, every company in the S&P 500 in the last quarterly earnings mentioned AI.
Yeah.
For the average company, average person, what is AI?
So it's you're trying to get a lot more insights from what you're doing already and try to make better decisions either on the revenue side or the cost side.
Because you have data.
You have data.
It's another way to organize data.
Yeah. So, you know, it's much easier to do on the consumer front because it's, you know, we have all the consumer data, you have the internet, you can feed off that. It's a little bit harder on the enterprise side because your data is extremely disaggregated in multiple systems. So it's a little bit of a longer process, means you have to buy the computers, which we're looking at, or the chips. Then you got to figure out how to put the data in a common data platform where you're going to bring all the data together from, let's say, hundreds of systems. Then you got to analyze it, and then you put the algorithm on top of it to get you insights. So it's a little bit more longer term view when it comes to enterprises, but a lot faster when it's a consumer application.
Well, explain to me this, like put some numbers on it for us. If we're looking at, what do you say, Dan? It was 800?
So 800 billion over the next decade of incremental spend that basically 6 months ago wasn't there.
Okay, wow. 800 billion over the next decade. And Dan, I'm going to come to you next on this. But explain how the math works here, because if you're looking at NVIDIA, I think that the stat I read or something was like the share price alone or the market cap alone off this rally has risen like one AMD or something like that, its most direct competitor. How do you price in 800 million worth of market over the next 10 years?
So one of the things you have to see is, you know, what kind of applications are going to be created? Who's going to be the big beneficiary? Mm-hmm. Now, we talked about a chip manufacturer. From our point of view, the cloud players are going to be the biggest beneficiary because you have to build this thing on a cloud. You can't really run it in your basement and come up with applications. These are things that require very fast computation and very large memory needs. So you need very, very large, cloud, hyperscale cloud provider. So that's one big beneficiary. We also think, you know, areas where such as you have a lot of consulting companies are going to come out and help out to create these applications. So that's very downstream work, but it really starts with the chip and the hardware level, then it trickles down to software, then it trickles down to services. Yeah. Everybody in the ecosystem will get some piece of it, and we've seen every company, ServiceNow just had their analyst day. They spent entire analyst day talking about, you know, how they're going to improve their product portfolio through it. Adobe did the same thing, you know, a few weeks ago. So everybody is spending crazy amount of money trying to make their products a lot more smarter for the users to use it.
All right, Dan, your turn. What's your price target, by the way, on NVIDIA?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, we think NVIDIA right here, I mean, $500, when you start to look at where this could be $500 to $600, could be fair value based on the incremental opportunity. And then you even streamline it to Microsoft.
Yeah.
Bull case. I mean, you could have a stock with a four in front of it because now all that incremental spend, it's going to Microsoft, it's going to Alphabet, it's going to potentially Amazon and others. In my view, like to your question, I view it that it, now look, execution is clearly, there will be issues. Now there's going to be losers, there's going to be AI roadkill as well.
Yeah.
But this goes back to basically a late 90s type feel in terms of trying to identify the winners. There'll be losers. Mm-hmm. From a valuation perspective, I think it's sort of it's a gold rush because now it really changes the whole paradigm in terms of what the revenue opportunity
is. Well, Paul, for our radio audience, it's worth saying, he said a four handle on Microsoft shares. Microsoft shares are trading at 321 right now, and a five handle on NVIDIA trading at about 380 a share.
Here's what I see, having been in this market for more than 30 years. I see the average portfolio manager anywhere in the world saying, I have to have exposure to AI. Calls up his tech analyst. Tech analyst comes back with the NVDA. That's what we're seeing here today. I don't see a $750 billion market cap stock up 25% on anything more than just panic buying almost.
But to your point, I mean, you call it FOMA, but so many investors that sit there in debt ceiling, macro valuation, you miss these moves in NVIDIA, in Microsoft, and Alphabet. In terms of institutional speaking, you're trying to figure out what font to use on the resume this year.
Right.
And I think that's sort of the issue. You could sit there, you could talk valuation until you're blue in the face.
Yeah. Yep.
That and $3 gets you a hazelnut coffee at Dunkin' Donuts.
All right, so when you're in Asia talking to clients and they say, I want to get exposure to AI, what do you tell them?
So on the China side, clearly there's Baba, Tencent, Baidu, you know, from a China perspective. But more and more, they're looking for U.S. And I view it as the basket. It's Microsoft. It's Alphabet. I view Palantir as a name that's a play here. Salesforce.com. You have the chip players, NVIDIA and AMD. And then you kind of go downstream. Datadog, Snowflake, MongoDB. I mean, you're really now starting to look at baskets. And that's why today it all changes. I mean, I view this as historic. If there was an earnings hall of fame, this would be historic in terms of what it means for broader tech.
Anurag, a quick question here on the infrastructure investment. Dan, weigh in if you have any thoughts. One of the things that overnight, I promise they're connected, but overnight, one of the things that was so shocking was kind of the DeSantis going on Twitter thing. Trust me, this connects. But Twitter essentially crashed. And a lot of people said, look, they were preparing for a bigger fallout without having the infrastructure to do it. Could a similar thought be applied to this kind of AI boom, that everyone's ready for AI, but the infrastructure can't catch up?
See, that's why I'm saying the hyperscale cloud providers are the right place to be, because you don't have a bigger computer than Amazon across the world.
Yeah.
Now, Amazon doesn't have partnerships with some of these leading AI algorithm companies right now, but I can bet you in the next 12 months, all of that changes. It is just going to happen. So you can't run this thing, you know, in somebody's back office. It just doesn't work that way. Now, we will, over time, at any given time, we will see crashes in the cloud infrastructure, just because that's the nature of it. It's a bunch of computers connected together. You know, somebody somewhere is going to do something stupid that will crash this thing.
I'd also say that Andy Jassy right now has a number of people in some room somewhere in Seattle, and they're looking at it like they see Microsoft, they see Alphabet. They got to figure out their AI strategy. Yep. And that right now, I think, is probably the biggest pressing need there.
All right, guys. Anurag, 10 seconds. What's your conference again today?
Yeah, Semiconductor Conference. You can see it on LiveGo.
LiveGo. Okay. And two of the best-dressed tech analysts on Wall Street right here, Anurag Rana from Bloomberg Intelligence, Dan Ives from Wedbush Securities, joining us here to help us put in perspective kind of what we're seeing out there as Dan was suggesting, kind of a historic day here for tech when you've got, it seems like the market's just opening its eyes today to what AI could mean across the tech stack, and that's what we're seeing. So we thank those gentlemen for coming in. This is Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You're listening to The Team. Catch our live program, Bloomberg Markets, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get off the NVIDIA trail for just a second. Go a little macro here, and we could do that with one of our all-time faves here, Danielle DiMartino Booth, CEO and chief strategist at QI Research. She was also a former advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, so we always appreciate getting her thoughts and her insight there. Danielle, let's just start with our good friends down in Washington, D.C., trying to figure out a way to pay the bills and everything. How does that whole, I guess, uncertainty factor in kind of to your outlook and your work?
Well, it factors in pretty largely, given I was around in 2011, and you know, now that we're talking about Fitch possibly downgrading the nation's credit, it's kind of getting real. And you know, for all of the headlines that speak of progress, that's the one thing that doesn't seem to be getting made is progress. So you have to stop and wonder, right?
Well, Danielle, talk to us a little bit about the fundamental agreement here, because the formula for GDP, let's do Econ 101, a big part of that is government spending. If you were looking at even the flatline offer from the Biden administration, which is just to keep spending the same as it is right now, that's still got to take some sort of toll on economic growth. Why are we worried about that?
Well, you asked a really fundamental question, and we should be worried about that, because once you dig into the guts of the GDP math, we haven't been getting a lot from the biggest traditional inputs of business investment and consumption. In fact, we've been seeing just the opposite. And if you look at Bank of America proprietary credit card, debit card data, that's trending in the same way as well. So these are the times when your economy is slowing into recession that you need the offset of government spending the most.
Exactly. So we had a little bit of economic data today. We're going to get some more tomorrow with the PCE deflator data, which is obviously real key with the Fed. But just on the jobless front, I mean, I don't know how you want to look at it. I know we had some squirmy numbers coming out of Massachusetts, the kind of stuff I usually expect to see in New Jersey. But anyway, jobs claims came in a little bit better than expected. The labor market still looks pretty solid. How do you think about it?
So I don't look at the labor market in absolute numbers. At QI Research, we haven't for some time. What we look at is the number of states that we have with rising claims, and that really does take all the Massachusetts noise out of the math. And we've had at least two-thirds of the states with rising initial and continuing claims here for a persistent period of time. And that tells you that while it is off a small base, a low base, historically speaking, as it would be coming out of a pandemic, that re-employed people who wanted to be re-employed and left people on the sidelines who were making enough from the government for a good long time. Think of how long the government was paying households rent and still is in states like California. But given the breadth of states, B-R-E-A-D-T-H, that are seeing rising initial and continuing jobless claims, we are at or past recessionary levels.
Danielle, is there a way here to still get that shallow recession, or is the hard landing still the growing base case?
Well, I think it grows with every day that the media tells us there's been quote-unquote progress on the debt ceiling front, and we
those dang
end
media.
Up at the end of the day without that progress. So once we can take the air quotes off progress and we actually see a deal done, and even in that case, the terminal had a story out a few days ago that said that Wells Fargo figured that if the debt ceiling was resolved by Labor Day, call it, which seems like we're not even at Memorial Day. So Labor Day seems a long ways away. But Wells Fargo said that even if the debt ceiling was resolved by Memorial Day, that the Treasury Department would have to sell somewhere around $1.5 trillion in treasuries between then and the end of the first quarter 2024. That's a lot of liquidity to pull out of a system that's already contending with U.S. households pulling money out of banks and putting them into investments that pay 5% or more.
Hey, Danielle, when I type in the Fed Go function into the Bloomberg Terminal, FED, I get a lot of information about the Fed and what's going on there. One of the easiest piece of data is they got another appointment on June 14th, which is not only Flag Day, but it's going to be a big day for the markets. I'm guessing the Fed's going to know something about this whole debt ceiling by June 14th, one would think. How do you think the Fed's looking at this news every day? Are they hanging on every word like we are, or are they just maybe working under the assumption that things will be okay?
So given I used to work at the Fed,
yes.
I kind of know who's who, and let's just say that Christopher Waller is as close to, if you can't get Waller, if you can't get Powell at a microphone, then you can substitute in Christopher Waller.
Okay.
He's about Powell's closest confidant. And yesterday he said he didn't like the position that the U.S. government had put Fed policymakers in, but that was not formulating into his calculus. I think that's a lot of the reason that we're seeing the probability of a June 14th rate hike, the highest since it's been. Now we're north of 40% there for June 14th. Yesterday, we were talking about, will we get 25 basis points by July? At this point, we're getting really close to a toss-up on June, and we've got some critical data between now and that meeting. And again, Waller's saying we are data-dependent. So if we get another hot employment report in, who knows? Who knows if they don't go right then on June 14th and raise the flag?
Danielle, connect those dots for us, though. How does the debt ceiling affect Fed policy? How much of it is inflationary?
Well, it's not inflationary. And well, back in 2011, the 10-year bond, the benchmark 10-year yield came down quite dramatically. It was a massive rally in the bond market. And immediately, the stock market shaved 17 percentage points. That's not a small move. So in that sense, it makes the Fed's job easier. But it is the disruptive effect of the financial markets that plays into how policymakers approach Fed policy. And if there's something that's highly disruptive, very difficult. And again, we forget that it's like the stock market does yoga before every Fed meeting, and financial conditions ease, things always seem to be nicer, more complacent. But again, that's just how it always seems to be, right at the cusp of Fed meetings. If there's a massive disruption in the financial markets because of this debt ceiling standoff, makes it much more difficult for the Fed to go.
Danielle, I've got EcoGo on my terminal, but that's basically all I have for economic indicators, and it's pretty high-level market stuff. I always know you always quote these really obscure things that for you are really important, and you think that really tell maybe a deeper story. What are you looking at now these days, and kind of what's it telling you?
So two things this week in particular, because it's been a pretty quiet economic data docket. We did see purchase applications for homes dip right back down to kind of that 30-year low. And at the same time, I've put what my trader buddies on Wall Street have said. They're like, Danielle, we've got Truflation up on our screens. Watch TRU, Truflation, since it's like checking a billion prices in real time. And it was kind of a moment. It was a threshold. It was a Rubicon that was crossed in yesterday's trading that it traded south of the 3% mark. So in the real world, I understand the beautiful models that come out of agencies and the Census Bureau and the BEA and the BLS and all of those happy acronyms in the statistical agencies. But in the real world, inflation is breaking below 3%, which is pretty close to the Fed's 2% target. So, and I'm seeing it. My grocery circular is thicker than it used to be. There are more things on sale, and I sure as heck don't see any help wanted signs where I am. These are the telltale signs.
Okay. Danielle DiMartino-Boo, thank you so much for joining us on this Thursday before Memorial Day weekend. We appreciate it. Danielle DiMartino-Boo, she's the CEO and Chief Strategist at QI Research, and she's a former advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, so really has a unique view into the Fed, and we always appreciate getting some of her time. And again, one of the many reasons we like talking to Danielle is because she looks at economic data sets that I didn't even know existed, but they do. And she looks at the data, and she's able to put that data into context for us and tell us why it's important and why we should focus on it.
You're listening to The Tape. Catch our live program, Bloomberg Markets, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, The TuneIn app, Bloomberg.com, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Let's step back a little bit, shift gears, and talk geopolitics. Let's head over to Europe. A lot of news coming out of Europe, of course, and where you want to get the latest on the war in Ukraine and some other topics over there. Let's go to Maria Tadeo. She's a European correspondent for Bloomberg News. She is based in our Brussels office over there, but she's all over Europe covering the big stories over there. So, Maria, thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy afternoon and evening. Let's start with Ukraine here. The counteroffensive, I kind of thought we might have seen it start by now. What's the feeling in Europe about when this may start, what it may mean, and how we should think about it?
Yes, and it's a very good question. And today I happened to speak with one of the senior advisors to President Zelensky on this matter. Now, what the Ukrainians will say, and you hear two sides to the story, they say we're still waiting for more weapons and the counteroffensive will be successful, but obviously they do not want to put a date on it. And then on the other hand, you also have other officials also from the Ukrainian government who say when you launch a counteroffensive, this is not going to be like D-Day when it all happens on one day and this is a make or break. This will be a series of events that will happen. So it's very difficult, and obviously for them too, it's not something that they would do to publicize a date or to say it has started already. But what I can say, especially when you look to European officials, is that this counteroffensive will be key. There is so much going on for Ukraine in terms of the momentum for the war, in terms of whether or not they can make significant gains. And the West has provided money. They have provided weapons. Obviously, it's the Ukrainian people that suffer the war. It's the Ukrainian army that fights the war and ultimately also dies in battle. I mean, that's the grim reality of this. But there is a sense that a lot is going on with this counteroffensive. It means a lot. If it doesn't go well, it could remove some of the momentum, this idea that Ukraine can win. If they are successful and they're able to claim some of the land back, it could change a lot of things in terms of what the future peace may look like.
So let's go from the war in Ukraine, Maria, to the economics of Europe broadly. Germany enduring its first recession. Talk us through the numbers here and essentially how the biggest economy in Europe is really being interpreted by its peers right now.
Well, Germany we always care about for two reasons. Obviously, it's the biggest economy in the euro area, so obviously the clout and the just kind of say they have in talks and negotiations when it comes to anything that gets done in Europe is tremendous. Obviously, this is a country that has the biggest pockets. It's also a big industrial power for Europe, too. And there has been this idea that we have to rebuild the European industry and that Germany will be key because of the, well, just simply the fact that they know how to make things and they make them very well and also export them very well. When you look at the number today, the recession, it is significant in some ways. If you look at the political narrative, Olaf Scholz, the chancellor, had repeated many times. Remember, he did an interview with our editor-in-chief about 2 months ago. And he said, we're not going to have this recession. We're going to escape this recession. They were trying to flip the momentum of it. Today, we see the economic reality is different. Having said that, are we shocked, surprised? Well, no, because the PMIs had been painting a bad picture for Germany. We knew that manufacturing was already in contraction. We knew that some of the implications of the energy crisis, this was not the winter from hell that we were expecting. This was not the terrible winter that would break Europe. But obviously, it has lasting effects on the industry. And now we see them play out. And beyond Germany, to answer your question, a bigger picture, I think it also reflects some of the fears that I hear and see in every panel that I do, in every conference that I've done over the past months. This idea that Europe is losing attractiveness when it comes to the industry. And there was a survey, just very briefly, but I think this is so key, that came out this week from a very influential European think tank that said 52% of CEOs would consider changing investments and operations and moving them to North America. That is terrible news for made in Germany. But beyond that, and here's another stat, and this is terrible, 80% of the CEOs that were surveyed, they said that they believe yes, Europe is losing competitiveness when it comes to the industry. So 80% of respondents that number is really, it is worrying.
It is. It is. And in Germany, just following up there in Germany, when I think of Germany, I think of some of these great industrial companies, Siemens and so on. And I think about them making big, big stuff and exporting it to China. So they must have a very difficult political and economic, tightrope to walk in terms of the relationship with China. How do they phrase it? How does the German government phrase it?
Yes, for sure. And it's not just the big companies in Germany that we all know of. And obviously, they make things that are very well and very well done and that they sell. But it's also the SMEs. Remember, Germany is a country that is built on small to medium companies, too, that then are interconnected with the big ones. But it doesn't stop there, because Germany is also a country that buys components and parts to countries like Italy. So a recession in Germany has trickle-down effects on countries like Italy. So overall, this is a very heavily connected economy. When you look at China, look, this is a difficult question for Germany, but also the European Union overall. When you see the G7 statement, and Olaf Scholz obviously participates, representing Germany, they all agreed in the communique that they have to de-risk the economy, not decouple. And they mentioned China in that statement 20 times. I have never seen that in a G7 statement. So that shows the political jitters are obviously playing out. They have been accelerated by the war in Ukraine. But for Germany, this is a very, very difficult question, because on the one hand, the relationship with Russia on the energy is over. The Nord Stream blew up, but also a major recipient of your exports. You're now having to rethink, is this country a partner? Is there a rival? Is it a challenge? And now what do? After years in which China was a huge market for Germany and continues to be.
Maria, in the absence of, let's say, some sort of transition or diversification away from China, who's the benefactor from Germany's perspective?
From Germany's perspective, look, it's a good question because it goes back to the initial point that I made on European CEOs being gloomy. What they feel is like, if we lose business with China, if we also have a lot of the regulation that kicks in, especially when it comes to the greening the economy, there's all these transitions that are going on, and we don't have the money and the type of subsidies that perhaps a transformation like this would entail, then one of the big beneficiaries is obviously the United States. And we know that for the Europeans, there have been a lot of concerns now for the Inflation Reduction Act, what they mean, when obviously they see a survey where one in two CEOs essentially say, I would consider relocating to North America. That is problematic. But at the same time, you find yourself in a situation where, again, politically and diplomatically, the United States and the European Union are very close now because of the war in Ukraine.
Maria, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate getting your perspective about all things Europe. Lots to think about there. Maria Tadeo, European correspondent for Bloomberg News. She does fantastic reporting from all of the hotspots around Europe, including Ukraine. So, again, some great color there from Maria Tadeo on the ground in Europe.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You're listening to The Team. Catch our live program, Bloomberg Markets, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts.
Next guest, this is the kind of stuff right in my wheelhouse. We're talking leverage finance, you know, putting loan. I had to first, when I was at Chase Manhattan Bank, we lent to a company called, it was Fleet Call. I was asking for a $250 million loan on no assets,
wow,
no cash flow. We were lending against air, and we got the loan. Our committee, it took us like 3 weeks of meetings, but we finally convinced her, and it turned out to be Fleet Call. We made a gajillion dollars on the warrants. Ted Swimmer, he knows what I'm talking about. He's head of capital markets at Citizens Financial. Ted, you guys at Citizens Financial, kind of mid-market, upper mid-market, financing deals, getting deals done. Tell us about that part of the market today, because here, Simone and I, we just sit around, we talk about the debt ceiling and the Fed and stuff like that. You're on the ground helping companies raise capital to grow and to buy stuff and build stuff. What are you seeing?
You know, it feels a lot better out there than it has in about a year, year and a half. A year ago, we saw M&A kind of cease, a lot of people concerned about how high rates were going to go. People uncomfortable with trying to raise debt in the public markets and the private markets. And we saw a real pause in M&A and in debt financing. If you've just looked the last 2 months, a fair amount of transactions have started to be announced, underwritten by banks, underwritten by debt direct lenders. We're starting to see the market unfreeze a little bit. And we're starting to see, especially for really good companies, a very, very active M&A market. So things feel a heck of a lot better than they did.
That kind of sounds surprising to me, because at the same time, you know, the Fed's talking about tightening lending conditions. You know, that's what we're hearing from money managers as well. And you're in this upper middle market space. Shouldn't this regional banking stress kind of take away from some of these things, have the opposite effect perhaps?
Well, there's a lot of different parts in the lending market. There's a leverage finance market, which is funded a lot by CLOs and things of that nature, and by direct lenders. And, you know, as banks sell a fair amount of these exposures off, the markets to do those have unfrozen. You've seen the secondary levels trade up both on the bank and the bond side, which are giving banks a lot more comfort in underwriting the transactions, which they didn't have this time last year. I mean, you saw how the bank index kind of went down about 10 points, bond index trading the low 80s. That's all reversed. And we're still not back to where we were 2021, but it feels a heck of a lot better than it did recently. But let's go ahead.
Now, I just want to ask you about one of the big topics that I like here, and it seems like a real growth business on Wall Street over the last several years, has been private credit, private equity, private credit.
Sure.
And coming out of the great financial crisis, a lot of the banks really were curtailed in their ability to take to type of lending they could do, the risk they had to take on, and that kind of created this private credit business. And it seems like they're raising money hand over fist. How do you view private credit in the marketplace as a competitor to you guys?
It's a competitor, and it's also somebody we work with. So
Okay. As
we underwrite transactions, sometimes we'll move it over to the CLO market, more of a more diversified market, and sometimes we'll work directly with private credit to help place deals. If you look at a lot of the deals that are coming out, some of the larger deals, you'll see a combination of bank underwriting and private credit both underwriting the transaction together now. So you're starting to see these markets, I think, start to merge a little bit more, and it's not just private credit or bank. You're seeing a combination of both. Blackstone did a deal last year where you saw them both use the bank market and the private credit market to get something done. So you've seen a combination of those markets come together.
Well, we talked about this enthusiasm for private credit. I mean, I feel like that's the only thing we read about on top on the Bloomberg Terminal. Has this gotten over its skis? Has too much money been raised? Or how does this money enter the economy over the next couple of years?
Well, it enters the economy with an increase in M&A flow. I mean, a lot of the deals that are being the financing is going into these new M&A transactions. And I think you've seen a period of time over the last year where there hasn't been a lot of M&A, and you've seen the private credit funds build up capacity. So there's a lot of unused capacity, which I think will help fund as people get more and more comfortable with valuations and whatever this new rate environment looks like, you'll see an avenue for both private credit and for CLO credit put to work in order to finance these transactions.
So you guys at Citizens hosted a conference in Atlanta recently, and presumably that's where you bring companies together, sponsors together, and you guys try to generate some conversations and hopefully some trades down the line. What was kind of the conversation when you brought these folks together?
Sounds like you were there, Paul. You described described it perfectly.
Been to many of them.
Yeah. You know, it was a very optimistic group. We've hosted this conference the last 4 or 5 years, and we saw more optimism. We had a record amount of attendance, a record amount of sponsors, financial private equity firms, and a record amount of companies looking to try to transact now. I think what we're hearing is for really solid companies, there's a very, very active market and an aggressive market to get those transactions done. For a little bit more storied credits, we're still seeing it'll be a little slow, but our pipelines right now are at a record amount. And it's just a question of, can we get a buyer and a seller together to do a transaction?
How about you? You host this conference, you get some conversations going, boom, you think you got a deal, you get them together, you go to your credit committee or you go to whomever. Can you get deals done, leverage deals or with a little hair on them? What's it like going to try to get some of these deals done right now?
It's not easy.
Right.
I mean, obviously banks are thinking about a lot of different things right now as they're putting capital to work. But again, a lot of these deals are distributed to markets where we can, which are very active and very liquid right now. I mean, to Simone's point earlier, you've seen a ton of private credit raised. There's a lot of desire to put money to work. You've seen very little loan issuance over the last year. So there's a really pent up demand on the CLO side. So although banks are not necessarily desirous to hold big capital commitments right now, there are other avenues of investors that are, and our ability to put the buyer and the seller together, take some distribution risk has never, I wouldn't say never been as good, but it is certainly improving over the last 12 months.
When you look down to, I guess, lower middle kind of credits, is that somewhere you see a little bit more anxiety?
Yes, absolutely. The lower, and just to clarify what we're talking about, I would say upper middle market is EBITDA sizes of $50 million or greater. So enterprise value somewhere between $400 and $1 billion type things. Mm-hmm. When you start looking at lower, that's become a market that has been more dominated by direct lenders as they've been able to do things that banks would have a tough time during the due to regulatory environment to get done. But the direct lenders can certainly do, as they're not obviously regulated by the bank. So we're seeing a lot of appetite for those type transactions getting done with direct lenders.
Because it was really interesting. The CEO of Citizens Financial was on Bloomberg Markets yesterday, and he was talking about how restricting, reining in credit by 2-3% was going to essentially help the Fed do its job. But it does seem to really disadvantage smaller businesses, smaller companies.
It's a great point. I think a lot of that was done prior, right after, as Paul mentioned, the Great Recession, when the regulatory environment became harder. We really saw direct lenders pick up some of the slack. But I think as you get to more corporate-driven transactions that don't necessarily have traditionally relied on the bank, I think that's where you're going to see some issues if things get tighter from a lending perspective, because banks are used to holding very large dollar amounts of those, and obviously that's going to become more expensive as capital becomes more precious.
What are some of the sectors you guys like right here? Sectors you like investing in and doing business with right now?
So we're doing a fair amount with data centers. Digital infrastructure is a great space for us right now. We're seeing we just purchased an M&A firm called DH Capital that specializes in that. And we've had a great run in that business, and we see that as a real growth engine over the next couple of years. Business technology, business outsourcing, things of that nature. We've been showing a commercial, industrial flow stuff. We're doing a fair amount in there. So those areas have really grown and seem to be somewhat, especially the digital infrastructure, somewhat immune to concern around the overall economy. That seems to be a never-ending need for capital in that business. So,
all right, Ted, thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it as always. Ted Swimmer, he's head of capital markets at Citizens Financial, joining us live in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. None of this phony and in garbage coming in live to the Bloomberg studio.
You're listening to The Tape. Catch our live program, Bloomberg Markets, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the TuneIn app, Bloomberg.com, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Driscoll. She's a luxury retail analyst for CoreSite Research, got lots of experience in the retail space. And Marie, let's start with the luxury space here. I'm just looking at LVMH. That's kind of one of the names I kind of know. And it's big. It's $400 billion market cap. I'm looking at the French shares that trade in France, up 20% year to date, up 50% on a trailing 12-month basis. Talk to us about retail space. What are you seeing out there these days?
So, if we're talking about luxury and LVMH, there's still pockets of money. The aspirational shopper is definitely more purposeful and making their purchases, you know, with thought. And we heard that from the likes of Walmart on up. But for a company like LVMH that has 75 brands in the luxury space, and brands that are powerfully supported throughout various economic cycles, these brands hold allure, and they rarely mark down their key brands like a Christian Dior or the Louis Vuitton. They're not marked down, and because of that, many consumers look at them as like stored value. Like, you know that when you buy it, you're not making a mistake. It won't be marked down next week. Luxury shoppers are still shopping. People are being more purposeful. And you do see a bifurcated market. The people that have are spending. And they're not spending flagrantly, but they're still buying luxury products. Luxury has also benefited from price increases for the last few years. China is coming back. So we expect to see a slowdown in U.S. consumption of luxury as the U.S. consumer deals with the impact of inflation and also reverts back to a pre-COVID lifestyle of increased experiences. Experiences are where the consumer is encountering severe inflation, you know, 20 to 40% increases in the price of going out to eat or staying in a hotel, airfare. And yet consumers want that. There's pent-up demand for that. And so as consumers spend on those experiences in America, they're less likely to be spending on another expensive handbag, though the handbag is the handbag that remains of choice, and they'll spend on it when they decide to do so. But this year, luxury will see the benefits of the Chinese returning to the market with the opening of China again. And other, like the UAE will be strong. And also you have Gen Z supporting, you know, a younger luxury shopper that is supporting luxury.
Right. Well, you know, we have been hearing from CEOs across the consumer space about this softening of U.S. demand. Take me through the details of that. Which demographics are feeling the pinch most, and who are the recipients of this potential cynicism and, you know, inflation tightening of belts from consumers?
Yeah. So you see, like, people are tightening their belts. Like, if you just listen to the Walmart call, people are purposeful. They're looking for bargains. Walmart, during COVID, Walmart attracted many consumers earning $100,000 a year or more. And of course, they're trying to retain them as customers. This year, you know, higher-end consumers, everybody feels inflation. And, you know, except for the 1%, most people feel inflation. They feel it in their grocery bills. They feel it in going out to eat and in their travel and various services and experiences. And so while there's demand for selected items, like if you recently Kohl's, which is very middle America, reported, and where did they see strength? They saw incredible strength in beauty. So people are still saying, I'm going to buy, I'm going to have this cheap taste of luxury and with a fragrance or a lipstick. And guess what? You can use a lipstick every day. So it's got efficacy, which is similar to using a luxury handbag. You know, so you can, there's room for that. For the last few years, we've spent a lot on casual attire. Kohl's saw a big increase in both men's and women's more occasion-based attire or dressy attire.
Right. So you know, with Kohl's, though, I mean, you saw shares pop up 7.5%. But I think, you know, during the day, that was quite a bit higher. Is it enough for these companies to just sort of like beat the estimates that their executives put out? Is that what we're seeing in the market reaction, or are we seeing some fundamental sense from investors that the consumer is a little bit better off than they had anticipated going into earnings season?
So, you know, reading enough and listening to enough calls during the last week or two, a few of the big takeaways are that while sales may not be meeting objectives and the consumer is more purposeful and there's winners and there's losers here, I'm going to quote what the Dick Haynes Urban Outfitter said. The hostile operating environment of the last few years has finally abated. Freight rates have normalized. Supply chain speed and reliability have returned. Our initial merchandise markup improvement initiatives have begun to bear fruit, and total inventories are down. And we're once again growing inventories at a slower rate than sales. That kind of the way he characterized his business is what I'm seeing across many businesses. While the top line isn't there, the erratic business operating environment we dealt with in the last 3 years with peaks of demand, not enough supply, then the rush of supply and too much and not enough demand is abating. And we're entering a time when now the costs of getting your products to the store are less. You're seeing a return to stores. Digital is slowing down. People are in the stores. So
the fundamental post-pandemic improvements, you know, that's what we're seeing rather than, you know,
consumer. And if we can get through a quarter or two of, you know, like the consumer, like these are the summer is the weak quarter. The summer is when the U.S. consumer is out traveling. If we can get through that, the second half of the year should be a better time. And I think investors should be looking at that.
Hey, Marie, China reopening. As I walk through Midtown and down Fifth Avenue and Madison Avenue, I see tons of European shoppers. I don't see Chinese. When are they coming back?
Yeah. So, you know, CoreSite is very close to the Chinese consumer. We have offices there. We have analysts on the ground, and we've been following them for probably 8 years and more. And what we're, you know, it's going to take 6 to 12 months for them to come back. They just opened up in February, basically, and it takes a while to get your travel plans in order. We don't really see it coming end of this year, next year. But the Europeans are here, and the Chinese are starting to travel domestically within the Asia region. And so many American brands will benefit from that.
All right,
and,
Marie,
you know, the European brand.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. They're welcome on Fifth Avenue. They're welcome on Madison Avenue. I'm sure I speak for all the retailers there. Because when you talk luxury retail, a big, big component, a big driver is the Chinese consumer. Marie Driscoll, luxury retail analyst at CoreSite Research, joining us here to talk to us all things retail. Despite some of the tough headwinds out there in terms of inflation and economic uncertainty, there are certain pockets of some retail strength, and we're seeing other areas where some consumers are trading down a little bit.
You're listening to The Tape. Catch our live program, Bloomberg Markets, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the TuneIn app, Bloomberg.com, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I think one of my favorite stories coming out of Bloomberg News this week was one by John Gittleson. About downtown LA's office distress shows the pain coming for cities. This is an incredibly well sourced and reported story, and it's got just killer graphics by Kyle Kim, and it really brings home some of the problems we're going to see in some of these big U.S. cities that you wouldn't necessarily think, but like L.A., go figure. So anyway, John Gittleson, he's a reporter, real estate reporter for Bloomberg News. John, thanks so much for joining us here. I said to our producer, Eric, we got to get John on here because this is a great story here. Talk to us about L.A. and some of the primo buildings, iconic buildings in L.A. They're in a lot of trouble, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. I mean, downtown L.A. has not really been a magnet for office workers for quite a while, but the pandemic really gave it this punch to the stomach. And so the biggest landlord, Brookfield, has defaulted on three buildings, and it's got more troubled debt out there. So $1.1 billion worth of loans, it's not been paying, and more trouble on the way trying to refinance those buildings.
Yeah, talk to me about what happens exactly to those buildings. I'm sure some of it we don't know. So Brookfield, in some cases, has said, we'll step away from this building completely, I believe, based on the story. But it's not necessarily true for all of them. Take me through the process.
That's right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of options. Basically, though, these buildings are underwater. So that means their debt is bigger than the value of the buildings themselves. So what can happen is the lender can say, okay, we'll take a haircut and you can keep running the building. You can keep managing it. Or the owner can walk away and somebody else could take over. The building could sell for a loss to a new owner. Theoretically, down the road, maybe some of these buildings could be converted to another use, like an apartment building. But a lot of these are kind of like 1980s, 1990s office towers that would be very hard to convert to apartments.
The 80s were very good for me, John. But be careful here.
Well, they weren't necessarily good buildings in today's world.
That's right.
You're in your prime, so.
Yep. So it's interesting, John. Like I noticed, you know, when my experience with downtown LA is I would go see Capital Research Group and the Trust Company of the West, and that was kind of it. All the other asset managers and financial firms were kind of scattered throughout the greater LA area. Who is in downtown before? I mean, even
well, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of law firms. There's a lot of accounting firms. Two of the towers, actually, that Brookfield owns, at the top of the building, one says EY Plaza, which is Ernst & Young. And the other one is Deloitte, another accounting firm. A lot of law firms. Those businesses are classic, like, we don't need all this office space because our workers maybe work in somebody else's office or they can work remotely. So they don't necessarily need to go downtown. Then there's a lot of government workers downtown. About a third of the employment base downtown is like city, county, state, federal, court type of government workers, many of whom continue to work remotely.
You mentioned potentially converting these buildings into, perhaps apartments or something like that. Kyle Bass, back, I believe last month, was talking about how, you know, maybe these buildings are just going to have to come down wholesale because they're not necessarily built for people to live in. I think he was speaking specifically about warehouses and that sort of office space, at least in, you know, smaller cities. But in LA, is that a realistic thing that could happen? These buildings get converted into residential real estate?
Well, I think the sort of trophy office buildings that you see in the skyline photos of downtown LA, those ones would be very hard to convert. But actually, there are dozens of older buildings built in the early 1920s scattered around LA that are now already converted to apartments, lofts, condos, and they were, before the pandemic, very attractive places to live. Downtown LA is relatively affordable and has a lot of new multifamily offerings compared to like the West Side or other parts of LA where there's it's very expensive to live and it's also kind of difficult to build new product. So there is a possibility that people will move into some of these buildings. The glass and steel late 20th century ones are going to have a very hard path forward, though.
Hey, John, just in about, 32 minutes, I'm going to begin my walk from Bloomberg at 58 and Lex to Penn Station at 34th and let's call it 7th Avenue. So right through the heart of Midtown Manhattan. And I'm going to see a lot of empty buildings, a lot of dark floors. But it's bad here, but it's a lot worse in other big cities like Houston and Los Angeles that your reporting brings out. So what are those cities thinking about?
Yeah, well, I mean, part of the problem with cities like Houston, LA, Atlanta, Denver, Dallas, they're car centric. So people have a lot of opportunities to go outside of the city to offices, to they have big houses that they can work from. Commuting to downtown is very hard. So, yeah, those cities have a problem. They're facing falling revenue. They're facing retailers who are not making street life very attractive. So urban planners are really kind of trying to figure out what to do with all of this real estate. Downtown could be potentially a great place to live. In LA, for example, there's great transportation downtown. It's a good place to leave, not necessarily just a good place to go into 9 to 5 during the day. So people who live downtown can get to a lot of other parts of this metro area. And jobs, yep. For example, in the entertainment industry, you may work in Hollywood 1 6-month period, and then you're going out to Burbank for a job for another 6-month period. So living downtown can be very central and easy to commute from.
Hey, John, one of the things that I, you know, maybe the next shoe to drop in this whole commercial real estate, office building, real estate story is we start seeing some transactions, some sales of buildings. And I think the write down that we'll see in some of these is going to be shocking to a lot of people. Have we seen anything change hands in Los Angeles to give us a sense of how far down that market's fallen?
Well, yeah, in LA, the Union Bank building sold in March for $104 million. It last sold in 2010 for $208 million.
Wow.
So there's an example.
Do the math there.
Yeah, 50% price drop. There was a motivated seller, and there was a little bit of timing. If you did the deal before March 31st, you didn't have to pay a 5.5% transfer tax. That's a new kind of disincentive to real estate investors in LA. So anyway, there are multiple, what should I say, factors at play here. But basically, it's going to have to get a lot worse before it gets better for offices here in LA.
Now, does this have a ripple effect on the residential space in LA that downtown is suffering? How does this emanate from that central area?
Yeah, well, if the offices are vacant, if people aren't on the streets, what's happened in LA is the sort of ratio between homeless and, you know, housed normal people has fallen out of whack. So there are fewer people going to offices, there are fewer commuters, and it seems like the population of people who are unhoused, who are not necessarily very, how to state this anyway, they can be scary. And so it's a deterrent to people, you know, there. It's a deterrent to businesses. There's just a lot of factors at play. Safety is a key issue being downtown that has really come to the forefront as office vacancies have risen.
Yeah, it's a challenge for LA, as your reporting indicates, but lots of other cities around the country. It'll be very interesting to see how this plays out over the coming years is probably how it's going to play out. Again,
it's going to be a slow melting ice cube.
Yeah, I think you're right, John. So that's John Gittleson. He is the Bloomberg News Real Estate Reporter. He's got this great story out. Check it out, Bloomberg.com. Check it out. Downtown LA's office distress shows the pains coming for cities. I also want to call out the graphics because I like pictures. They help me understand things. So the graphics here by Kyle Kim were outstanding. Really blended really well into this story. And it just gives you a sense of how tough things are out there in the commercial real estate business.
Yeah, making real these numbers.
Exactly. Exactly. And what it means for the lenders. You know,
yeah,
I mean, that's
absolutely
the next wave that a lot of people are concerned about. Are we going to start seeing banks take some big write-downs on commercial real estate? So good story.
You're listening to The Tape. Catch our live program, Bloomberg Markets, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the TuneIn app, Bloomberg.com, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Simone Foxman, Paul Sweeney, here in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Seems like for months all we've been talking about is AI, and then of course in the last 24 hours with NVIDIA, even more to the front and center. Let's bring AI to investing. People are doing that. Our next guest is part of that whole wave, Francis Oh. He is the APAC CEO and head of AI ETFs, and the firm's name is Kraft Technologies
with a
APAC.
Q.
With a Q, Kraft with a Q. Francis, you know, we're applying AI, or at least people believe we're applying AI to just about everything we do in life. I think it feels overdone to me, but what do I know? How about for in the business of investing? How can artificial intelligence help individual investors just kind of navigate the whole investment process?
Right. First of all, thanks for having me here. It's great to speak more about how the Kraft Technologies are applying the AI into the investment practices. We have been developing our AI model since 2016, two different areas. One is stock selection based AI, the other one is the asset allocation type of model.
Okay, so one is stock selection, one is asset allocation. Two important things you've got to get right as an investor.
Yes, yes, exactly. And the technology we are using is something similar to ChatGPT as well. ChatGPT is the core AI engine is a transformer engine, and the transformer engine is a combination of attention layer. Attention is a difficult term, but attention layer itself, what it does is trying to analyze the relationship between the input data. So when we type something into ChatGPT, ChatGPT is trying to analyzing the wordings or the sentences or paragraph to analyzing relationship, trying to get the context, what we are asking to them. So they deliver the answer back to us. Where we are applying that attention layer to our stock selection model is trying to analyze input data. Price data, fundamental data, and macro data, and relationship of that to the future expected return of the stock within the universe. So we've been using that since 2019, that for our stock selection model. But yesterday, we launched our AIDB, AI-powered asset allocation ETF.
So the ticker is AIDB for the ETF. Okay.
Yes, but that is the asset allocation type of ETFs. We first launched it in here.
Well, congratulations on the launch. I've been looking back.
They rang the opening bell today, the New York Stock Exchange.
Nice.
Yeah, that's cool.
It was so honored.
It's a cool experience.
Yes.
You know, look, I'm looking back at the performance of some of the ETFs that you have out there. Pretty spectacular 2020, 37.6% for the U.S. large cap ETF.
Yes.
But, you know, what's clear is it's not always
not
market
always
beating, at least against the S&P total return. When does AI perform better? Or when do AI-generated investment decisions perform better than the overall picture? Is there any sort of common threads that go into this?
Okay. So it's very the question. Yes, 2020, we rallied a lot. 2021, it started to decrease a bit. Remember the moment of the AlphaGo, when the AlphaGo was beating the professional Go players. It beat the human most of the time, but only the one game, it was losing the game, was there was unexpected. The play was happened by the professional Go player. And it could be similar to the our AI model as well. Something unexpected happened. For you have like the very sharp the regime reversion or regime changes, it could be make our AI model a little confused on the stock selection, but that could be also happening for the human portfolio manager. And the main difference is, or the possible distinctive advantage is the AI model at least doesn't have ego, like the big portfolio manager. It didn't attach it to the previous investment decision making to the next one.
So, does that make moments like GameStop and the meme crazes, does that make it a little bit easier for you guys to capture that?
Was the moment, yes, but our existing ETFs are mostly the large cap. It didn't get to have a chance for the GME or the other meme stock yet, but it could be, yes.
So, to what extent, Francis, are retail investors or retail advisors, retail investors, institutional investors, to what extent are they using AI today? Is it happening? Is the typical broker out there or fund manager using artificial intelligence?
It starts to boiling in the market right now. So we are the B2B solution provider. And then lucky enough, get the sizable funding from SoftBank Group, beginning of the last year,
good.
146 million. So we currently provide, we have our AI tip ETF, but at the same time providing our solution to 20 different financial institutions for portfolio signals or trading execution model, et cetera, et cetera. And right now the big agenda I'm keep hearing from our potential partners is the how to leverage AI to deliver a personalized investment solution or advice back to the clients. The like for example, like banking or the wealth managers, the top tier of the clients is covered by the human private bankers, but those who are under is still. And the dead areas could be probably worse up by the AI.
Well, as a market participant that uses a lot of the AI technology, and we're looking at, you know, this massive gain in NVIDIA, on the verge of maybe, I mean, maybe it surpassed at this point, a $1 trillion company. How do you see some of this demand for chips, for these various different components? Because you're putting together these models that use that stuff, right?
Yes, we use a lot of chips from the NVIDIA. Yes, we spend a lot of money.
Well, is this overplayed?
Yes, it's true. But at the same time, I believe the ChatGPT is really changing the game for the AI in the public space or the private market. It gives the two-way the experiences and start to building up the trust of this is the level of the AI can deliver back to the client solution services or et cetera, et cetera. So there will be more and more demand. And one interesting thing for the NVIDIA is the beginning of this May, the one of our AI ETF, AMOM, US Large Momentum ETF, it dumped Apple and then pick the NVIDIA as the top holdings. So we are seeing a huge gain today. I'm excited about it.
How about for your just 30 seconds left, sure. the demand for your ETFs. What are you seeing out there? Who's interested in your ETFs?
Yes, mostly from the who have the savvy understanding of the tech background,
okay.
Or the who wants to fearlessly, that want to experience the new adoption of the AI could be helpful. What I want to envision in the 5 to 10 years later is one of our goals is trying to deliver a sustainable alpha generative solution by the AI. And if that is happening, I believe there will be a moment that AI powered investment solution become a new beta in the market.
Great stuff, exciting stuff. Francis Oh, I'm glad there's somebody doing this stuff. Francis Oh, APAC CEO and head of AI ETFs. Man, technology changes everything. Kraft Technologies APAC, that's the name of the firm. They've got some ETFs out there really using to integrate artificial intelligence into the investment process. And why not using AI for just about everything else in life? So we've learned just maybe in the last 6 months, it seems to have been front and center.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.